Hello and welcome to Next 2.0. I'm your host, Marcus Atkinson. 2.0, that means that this is a continuation or a new iteration of what you've come to know as Next with Marcus Atkinson. We still want to analyze what leaders are next in our community. We still want to analyze what issues are next in our community. But now we want to add more of a national flavor to it. And then also you'll be able to catch us on a weekly basis, as opposed to just a once a month basis. You're accustomed to tuning in at 91.3 FM, the fourth Sunday of the month at 4 o'clock. You'll still catch it at that hour, which you're probably listening on the show right now at that hour. But you'll also be able to listen once a week on our podcast station. It's available on a lot of different platforms. For example, it's available on Spotify, Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Pocket Cast, TuneIn, and more. Not to mention Passport here on WQLN and on the greater website for WQLN NPR on a national level. We're excited about this and just the opportunity to bring you more content, more guests, and more information. Some of the people that we've had on our show in the past, we've enjoyed a great deal. Some guests have been on multiple times. Two of the people that join me in studio today have been on the show for various topics, and I keep bringing them back because I enjoy their take so much so that on my own network, The Public's Voice, they have had different offerings and they've interviewed different people with me and solo because I've enjoyed listening to them so much and so have other people in our audience. Saying that, The Public's Voice, which is my own personal media company, is now a partner in the production of Next 2.0. And so that's exciting for us as well. So without further ado, the two individuals that I'm referring to are, one, to my immediate left, Mr. Chuck Camerata. Chuck, welcome to the show and welcome to the platform.
Cool to be here.
And then Mark Blunt. Mark, welcome to the show and to the team.
Hey, thank you, Marcus.
All right. Appreciate it. And so I want to start with Chuck. Chuck, let's go back to you and I. Mm-hmm. How did we first meet? You refresh my memory here.
How did we first meet? I don't remember. You refresh my memory. You got to remember, I'm the old guy in the room. I forget stuff.
Yeah. I want to say we met through our churches at the time.
You came out to my church to speak.
There you go.
Yeah.
I came to your church to speak, and then you and I got a chance to get to know each other a little bit better, and that just led to
lots of great conversations.
Yeah. We just had a great conversation the other day at a local coffee shop, and it just kind of grew from there. You have a very unique take when it comes to religion, spirituality, things along those lines. Touch on that a little bit so people can get a feel for who you are and how you approach these topics.
Well, I don't know how unique I am, but I think that the popular perception of religious leaders in the culture doesn't particularly fit who I am. I made a journey. I became a Christian and in an evangelical church organization in college. A really wonderful group of people blessed my life. But that was kind of a narrow way of thinking for me. And so over the years, I've been expanding my understanding of faith, my way of reading the Bible, and I've grown to be a person who wants to emphasize what Jesus teaches rather than what Christianity, the religion, is all about. Mm-hmm. And so for me, people ask me if I'm a Christian, and I say, I suppose, but what I really am is a Jesus person.
Right.
And if you look at the four Gospels and you read the things that Jesus has taught us, man, that's profound stuff. And that's kind of where I come down, focusing on the teachings of Jesus, which ultimately, in my mind, are about loving one another.
And actually, one of the podcasts that Chuck and I are working on right now on the Public's Voice Network is a show entitled Christianity Sucks, Jesus Not So Much.
Yes. Absolutely.
And in that show, we'll talk about that as well, because I think we have that in common, man.
Yeah.
I'm a very spiritual person.
Right.
At the same time, I recognize just the detrimental role that Christianity has had when it comes to our, you know, man-to-man and person-to-person interactions historically in this country and abroad. And so we just want to analyze that from that perspective.
Absolutely.
Yeah, Mark has been one of my barbershop sparring partners for a while. You know, we used to have some of the best conversations there.
Don't you guys have to have hair to be a barbershop?
Well, that tell you how long ago it was.
So Mark is in the barbershop getting his beard trimmed up while I was naked. But we'd have great conversations there, and it was always, you know, sometimes you have that partner that even when the haircut is done, you sit there for that extra hour and have discussion. That was always Mark for me. And so, Mark, I know that for those of you that may have watched on television, you know, the football great Deion Sanders has really brought a lot of attention to Jackson State University yes. as one of our more popular HBCUs. And a lot of people didn't know about Jackson State, and they got to know Jackson State through Deion. Well, Mark actually attended Jackson State, as did a lot of my relatives. And that was kind of the genesis of a lot of our discussions. But when it comes to our role in society, especially as people of color, black folks in particular, Mark has had a lot of profound and deep takes where that's concerned. Mark, talk about the genesis of our relationship.
That now you've made me curious. Because it seemed like I've known you forever. So I don't really know. I just know that whenever we've been around each other, we usually have a very serious conversation that always left me thinking about something or engaging. It was always an engaging conversation that made me think. And most people that know me, I'm a conversationalist. And I like to talk about many topics. And Marcus has been that type of person where I talk about anything with him, and we've always kicked it. And some of his family, as he said, Michelle, went to Jackson State, so we had that in common. She was at Jackson State. Michelle Young was there when I was at Jackson State. So we've talked like that. And his mother, I knew his mother very well. And so we've been knowing each other for quite some time.
Yeah. And just thinking back to some of the shows that we've recorded for the Public Voice platform. Chuck, one of my favorites was your interview with Dr. Catherine Dumay.
Kristen Cobes Dumay.
Yeah. And her book was called Jesus and John Wayne.
Yeah.
I can't remember the exact full title, but you know, I heard the title. I went actually and bought the book online, and I read through it before we interviewed her. And man, I'm at give the listener a kind of a taste of what that interview was all about.
It's really interesting stuff. Do you know what Hillsong is?
Yep.
The church Hillsong, big church that was developed in Australia, a mega church. And
can I say this before? If you're listening right now and you are a part of one of these larger, predominantly Caucasian churches, you're allowed to use songs other than Hillsong songs. You do know that, right?
That's right.
It's like these people act like they can exclusively only use. Yeah, yeah. It's the same recipe every church, but I digress.
Those are the only sanctified songs. You know, but the thing about Hillsong is that a lot of churches are not using their songs now because there's been a big controversy there, and that's not something to go into. But Kristen Cobes Dumay was central to the documentary that Hulu did on Hillsong.
That's right. She was in it.
She was in it in each one of the four episodes, talking about her understanding of the history of the evangelical church, the white evangelical church in the United States, and how destructive it has been to us culturally and how it continues to be. And it's not popular to talk about, but starting with Billy Graham, the kind of toxic masculinization of the church, and that's where the John Wayne part comes in. That we've replaced Jesus with the kind of masculinity that John Wayne represents. And that's just a small part of her evaluation of or takedown of the white evangelical church. It just reminds us that we were talking about this before we started recording, that it's really not about what the church teaches, or it's about the fundamentals that Jesus teaches us, which has nothing to do with the craziness that's out there today. I have a sticker on my bike, my motorcycle, that says, "Who would Jesus hate?" I ask that to people all the time. They don't have a lot of answers for that. And yet, the church is out there promoting dehumanization and demonization of marginalized groups. It makes no sense to me. Mm-hmm. So Cobes Dumay is this white professor from a conservative Christian college in Michigan who is out there in the forefront saying, "We're really missing it, folks. We need to rethink how we do church."
When I look back at my old shows, The Legacy of Dr. King was one of the shows that Mark sat in. Mark, you sat in on. And obviously, if you're talking about the legacy of Dr. King, the black church is centrally focused in so much of our history in this country, if not our entire history in this country. The evolution of the black church goes way back, you know, to much of those days. You know, talk about just as you think about church and community. I know that you have some opinions on what that looks like now, but just the impact that it's had and the impact that it continues to have as we wrestle with some of the same issues in community.
I have kind of, I don't want to call it a love-hate relationship, but historically I would I would like to say when it comes to our church and our history, it's like it goes hand in hand, because today's modern culture looks at the church as some type of, I don't know, soft view in our history. Like they take the nonviolent thing, but I have to remind people, Nat Turner was a preacher. And Nat Turner, what inspired him about freedom was the Bible, mm-hmm. as he interpreted it. So it's not always, a lot of people look at the church as being, or creating a docility to the African-American community. And I say, no, it has a hand-in-hand part with it. However, I do feel like in today's time, every minister is not Dr. King. And we have a Dr. King syndrome here where we say, if we have a project going on in our community, or it could be economic, it could be what have you, and we feel like we have to have a pastor there speaking for us. And I don't think all of them have those type of qualifications. I'm not mad at them. I'm not doing any hating or anything. But I just feel like a lot of people look to our ministers, just or unjust, for things that they may not be qualified for. Mm-hmm. Or they might have a revelation, but that don't mean that they can create jobs. That don't mean they could do surgery. That don't mean that they could do anything like that. And we kind of look to them because of the legacy of Dr. King for that. Some ministers are just meant to do that, just minister. And so that's my take on our church. However, acknowledging that that's one of the places where we can meet. And that was one of the places where that day in the field, we had a day off where we could rest and we could congregate and say some of the things that we wanted to say. So I honor that legacy of the church. I was brought up in the church, and I appreciate that the church was there and still there today.
Mm-hmm. And as Dr. King pointed out, it is the most segregated hour or two or four if you go to a traditional black church.
Yes, indeed.
The most segregated hours of the week is that Sunday morning. Chuck, this goes back to our Genesis, because I know, you know, when you have racial issues, one of the things churches are very good about is, let's get some white folk that we know, let's get some black folk that we know, let's get them on a stage and have a kumbaya fest.
Yeah.
Around Jesus and the Bible and around race, and then people walk away from these conversations feeling good that they've had the conversations, and we go back to our lives. You know, as you see these kind of think tanks, if you will, people coalescing around these, how have you come to view these type of meetups as time has gone on versus actually going after racial unity and reconciliation?
I think one part of the church is recognizing is that it's not about the sort of facade of connection with people of color. And I'm talking about the white churches. I think in the 35 years I was pastoring in a comfortable white community, that we had two, maybe, people of color part of our congregation in all that time. Not because we rejected those folks. They used to live in our community. And so we had no experience with it. 30 years ago, we had a cooperative relationship with Charles Mock's church when he was at Shiloh Baptist, and we learned a whole lot of what we needed to do from that, because that was just symbolic. And so what we began to learn was that we have to be really intentional about connecting. We need to build relationships with people who aren't us. And so we tried to develop a program for having dinners in each other's homes and getting to know one another. But it has to go to the next level now, beyond the sort of public stuff. We need to know one another. We need to work with one another. We need to develop projects that include us on teams working together.
Mm-hmm.
And that requires that we in the white church make that effort.
Yeah. Mark, tie this to economics, because we're at a time right now in Erie, and this is a huge topic it's a huge topic of the show. We're at a time where people are staking their claim in Erie. I think it's a wonderful thing from various different directions. Different organizations are starting to pop up handling different issues, societal issues, different businesses, different coalitions. When you look at the economic landscape of Erie, how are minorities faring in becoming a more integrated part of the economic fabric of Erie? What's your grade on that?
My one thought is, I'm getting old. I want to go back to something. I'm going to answer that. I want to go back to something that you was asking about our churches connecting. And I really believe this. If the issue or the goal is racial harmony, and I commend those churches that reach out to each other and try it at their level, I would say to our black churches, because they would know, and this is something that we need to discuss. I believe the white church is looking at our community and they're saying, well, the church has historically been where they've been. Our church, the black church, needs to work on reaching out to our own young men. Because if you look at them in their congregation, the men is not there. So when they're out there negotiating or they're out there networking, who are they speaking for? Because they're speaking for a population that they're not even connected to. And so there's a double whammy right there. There's an effort that's saying like, hey, we're putting out our hands. We're trying to communicate with you and we're trying to work with you. But who are you really working with? Who are you really reaching? Now, going, and I'm going to tie this up to this economic thing that you're talking about. We have young entrepreneurs, both men and women, that are now opening up businesses left and right. And they're not waiting. They're not doing it necessarily the traditional way. They're not necessarily saying, hey, if I don't get this SBA loan, I'm not going to exist. They're doing pop-ups now. Mm-hmm. They're doing things like that. They're creating. We're in a new age, in a new era. And because of the people that went before them, like selling clothes, I think we're beyond selling t-shirts now. We do more than beautician shops. We're consultants. We're buying up properties. Hey, Marcus, what you, some of the things that you all are doing, the Eastside Renaissance. We have a guest here later on, and we're talking about Open Minds that's doing consulting. I just say now we're evolving because information is out there. Accessibility is out there. And that's something that we didn't really have when I was coming. When I was coming, I had my subways. I went through the traditional, hey, I went to the bank, and hey, PNC treated me, I felt like, unfairly. And eventually it led me to some other means, and we went that route. And we opened, and it wasn't too many people like me at that time. But now I see it left and right, and I'm encouraged by it. And I applaud some of these young people that are building their own bridges, or as Tyler Perry would say, they're building their own tables.
There you go.
They're not waiting, you know, to sit at a table.
Yeah. Well, when you look at this, these are the primary pillars of a show like this, because religion, politics, and race, all roads are going to lead through those roads, if not converge through them in a winding fashion. You know, and I don't care if you do go back to the days of King or right now, you know, you can talk about, for example, the rise of Trump. You still got to talk about the role that evangelical churches play in that. You still have to talk about the polarizing environment racially that has been put more into focus behind his. Everything we deal with here is going to come through the lens of politics, religion, and race. And so, Chuck, you've been in a lot of discussions that have just kind of watched that has seen the convergence of these different topics. And yet we seem to continually not get it right.
Gosh,
in community, true. You know, and so it's a loaded question, but where are we missing it feels like when it comes to our humanity as it relates to these different topics?
Yeah, it's a really good question. Good point that you made about young men, Mark, not being in the black churches. Bane in our churches either. When I first came to Fairview, this is 35 years, 40 years ago, there were 80% of the people who were involved in the church were women. So we're all hurting in some regards with having young men in our churches. But having said that, I think from the start, race, religion, and politics, it's all tied together. You can't untangle them. And for the white churches, I think we're just understanding that. We're just finally. I think George Floyd was a seminal moment, not in the sense that things changed after George Floyd, because they haven't really, but in the sense that, to use the word that is the demon word for people on the right, it was a time when people on the right, or on the left, white people, woke up and said, you know what? It isn't easy to be a black person in this culture. And yeah, we still have race problems here. It's still a big issue. And we began to understand that it was not just, I don't like black people. It was systemic. That's the real race problem, is that it's baked into our system, race and politics, and it gets supported by the church. Mm-hmm. So all of those things are tangled up together. In fact, that's where the religious right kind of came to be in this country in a powerful political way, was when Bob Jones University was had their tax-exempt status removed by Richard Nixon, by the way, because of their discriminatory policies against blacks. And the white evangelical church in the South was livid about that. And so they had to find a way to put together a coalition to work against that. they recognized that they had no path forward to win, that they were going to lose every election going forward. So they began cobbling together constituencies that would allow them to hold on to power. And that's when the abortion issue became a big issue in the mid-70s. But it was not really about abortion. Abortion was used as a tool to make arguments and to bring in new constituencies, but it was really about race. It started with the Bob Jones stuff and the Liberty Christian University, whatever Jerry Falwell School was called. And so we're just learning those things. So the rash of books that came out over the last 7, 8, 9, 10 years, written by people like Ta-Nehisi Coates, who are saying, there's stuff going on that you don't understand. And I know a lot of people like myself are paying attention to that really honestly for the first time. Mm-hmm. And so this awakening, this wokeness, I think it's a thing that, and the fact that that on the right they have demonized being woke is really instructive, because they recognize the power of being awake, and so they don't want people to be awake.
Yeah.
And kind of that's the start. That's the seed that's been planted in the white church. Mm-hmm. And we need to nurture that
What you just described is what was called the Southern strategy.
Yes.
And the law and order strategy of a lot of politicians. It was some with Nixon and some a little bit before, because the real issue was power. The Republicans had nowhere to go. And as he said, they needed a way to realign, because the Democrats, the South was Democratic. Mm-hmm. And after the Civil Rights Movement, they had no home. Mm-hmm. And the Republicans that were inherited black folk, basically because of Lincoln or what have you, all of a sudden, they didn't have a home, because they said, well, how do we maintain this White House? How do we get back? And so when they lost their constituency because of civil rights, because of the voting patterns, they had to make Nixon wasn't even a religious person. And he had to make alliance with the evangelicals. And he was always suspicious about him. You can read his books or hear his tapes. And they, to this day, they've made a deal with these people. And it was about power. They didn't really even care about race. That's the whole tragedy of this whole thing. They unleashed something, and now they can't pull it back. Trump is the same way. They've unleashed this, and now you get a January 6th. Now what do you do? Mm-hmm. Because you can't pull these things back. You justified these thoughts, these behaviors, and all you was doing was just trying to maintain power.
And that's one of the things that I think Kristen Kobus DeMay said.
Yep.
Donald Trump is not the point at which things got bad.
Nope.
He wasn't the one who released the monsters. He was the logical conclusion of the policies and the theologies of the evangelical church and the right-wing political movement in this country. And he is the beast that they didn't want to unleash but did. And now they don't know what to do with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Chuck started talking about wokeness. I said, well, if Ramaswamy is listening to this, we're going to get some hate mail behind him using that term, boy. You know, and you're absolutely right. It's fascinating just to kind of watch all this play out. The January 6th events, I can't wait to go back and revisit that show, because just watching the way the trials are playing out for Trump right now, and just the idea of, and I won't go too deep into it because, again, this would be a full-blown show, to see Ron DeSantis do his best Trump impersonation only to have it used against him later on. Well, you know, if I'm running, why do we need the imitator? Right? And he's losing traction, but then you do have Ramaswamy coming in and just kind of giving I don't want to say a fresh take, but a repackaged version of much of what we're talking about. You know, at the end of the day, you want to grab a couple of these people and shake them and say, open your eyes, man, which is where Brandon comes in with opened eyes. Good. Brandon Wiley, July 20th, 2015, I graced the cover of the Erie Times News, and I was doing an interview. It was one of my first interviews, and the person I was interviewing at that time was Brandon Wiley. So I meet this young man at the Joaquin Center at that time. I was the director, and the first question I asked was the obvious: are you related to the Ben Wiley? And he was not. Is not. But as I listened to this young brother, it was obvious that, oh man, this young guy has a future here. Mm-hmm. And he started talking about the organization that he wanted to launch and some of his goals and everything else. And I said, you know, one, it sounds like it's needed. Two, it sounds like this is the perfect person to really get this thing off the ground and make it the success that I think community needs it to be. And so we had to bring Brandon back for this first episode of Next 2.0, seeing that he was such an important part of the first iteration of Next. Brandon, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's great to be back.
That was July 2015. And so now I'm sitting here, I'm thinking, man, that is 8 years ago.
It's crazy.
8 years ago. Tell us about Open Eyes from then to now.
Wow. First of all, I think you were like my first public or appearance that I'd ever done from a media standpoint. Yeah, so. Yeah. I appreciate you. You really believed in me and the message. And at, you know, obviously at the time it was just a thought and an idea that really was manifesting. Mm-hmm. Opened Eyes was, you know, this cultivation of thought and bringing some people together that are still with me today. And I have to always shout out my Opened Eyes team because I have a group of individuals who have completely been riding out with me for 9 years. Mm-hmm. So that are still part of it now and have believed in the message and have adopted the message, which is beautiful and it's important. You know, at the time, you have this idea, you're young, you're spry, you're like, yeah, I'm gonna change the world. And sometimes reality hits and, you know, people don't always believe in what you're presenting to them. And so I went through a number of emotions and a number of roller coaster rides since then, where I've shelved Opened Eyes, but something always continuously brought it back to me. Mm-hmm. And I'm a person of faith, as everybody's talking about faith and religion. Like, I was actually, what brought me to Erie was I was actually in the St. Mark Seminary. I was studying to become a Catholic priest.
I laugh every time.
So that's a lot of people do. And so, yeah, that's what brought me to Erie. I had no intentions on being here. I was planning on going to a whole different school. I felt a calling to the priesthood, and that's what brought me to Gannon. And ultimately been here for 17 years. But, this manifestation of Opened Eyes, you know, the roller coaster ride of trying to figure out, is this worth anything? Do people actually believe in it? When I started it, it was during the times of, it was during the Trayvon Martin case. Mm-hmm. And the basis, you know, behind Opened Eyes is my own experiences being a biracial man. Hearing the question, what are you? Mm-hmm. That's actually our philosophical question now that we use in my program is the what are you question. But that question at one time mm-hmm. was very negative for me, and it brought a lot of negative connotations to my life until one day I had a dream about writing a book and calling that book, What Are You? A Journey to Self-Discovery. Mm-hmm. And from that dream and that book came the program. So it was an ongoing process. But of course, the past 9 years hasn't been easy. And it wasn't until really George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and just the pandemic that things with Opened Eyes really started to really come together. And it's unfortunate that it took a tragedy such as that for people to, you know, sit back. And as you were saying, it really just kind of opened people's eyes, no pun intended, yeah, to the idea that, oh, we still have a problem here in America that we need to address. And from that moment, you know, as we're all sitting in the house trying to figure out what we're going to do next, people started reaching out to me like, oh, Brandon, you have a program, don't you, that addresses these things. Would you mind coming in and talking to my organization? Would you mind coming in and talking to my group? You know, whatever. So I took it as an opportunity. Oh, maybe I started this for this moment in time. As they say, timing is everything. Mm-hmm. And trust me, it wasn't. And when people would say, oh yeah, Brandon, like, it's so great to see you, you know, doing well. And I said, I've been doing this almost 10 years now. You're just really, really maybe hearing it within the past three. I've been at this for 10 years, really my whole life, but really the cultivation of Opened Eyes was 10 years. And just now things have really started to blossom and manifest, and thank goodness that I stuck with it, because I have been able to take Opened Eyes into a space of elevation and manifestation and expand our territory. And of course Erie has been welcoming to that idea, and I've worked with a lot of organizations and corporations, everything from Erie Insurance to your smallest nonprofit to your school district. And then from there it's been expanding outside of Erie, outside of the state. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have found ourselves in Philadelphia and Columbus, Ohio, and Buffalo, New York. And, you know, I did a talk down in Texas, and I also incorporate a little motivational speaking. So all of these opportunities have opened themselves to us. And I'm just thankful and I feel blessed. And I'm taking advantage of every single opportunity.
And to think that Next is responsible for launching such a successful program.
Yeah.
And what a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
It was all you, Mark.
It was. I mean that one. He was the first media appearance that I had. I mean that. So I'm always thankful for you believing in that.
So this is the one to wrestle with. Person comes up to you and they have the biracial child. And let's just say that biracial child is black and white. That traditional combination in a country like ours. And so they say, you know, I'm raising my child to be his or her best self. You're not all this, you're not all that. Especially if that child is a young male. As they grow and they go off into society, Mark, you know where I'm going with this. Society puts you into a category. And be it the darkest of the darkest brothers or the bright-skinned brother with curly hair and green eyes. Mm. The world looks at you as black. How do you talk about that to people, especially people that have biracial children or that they themselves are biracial?
Yeah, you know, it's such a crazy thing because you're right. Society is going to, you know, my experience personally, I feel like I always had to be or act a certain way. You have to basically, you are this, so you should be this. Mm-hmm. You are this, so you should talk like this. Or you are this, you should dress like this. And I have a lot of people who come up to me with biracial children, and they say I'm having some significant issues. Mm-hmm. So this is a regular reoccurrence. And of course, I get it. I understand it. And they're thinking to myself, like, my child feels like I have to pick a side, but society still is going to view them as black individuals. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's how you're grouped. That's how you're going to be. Now, when people ask me, how do I identify? Yes, I say I'm biracial, but I identify more with black culture. Mm-hmm. That's just me personally. I acknowledge my cultures. I'm my mom's 100% Italian woman, you know, so she's a proud Italian woman, you know, so I love my Italian side. I always represent that. But really what this comes down to, you know, with race and figuring out where you're at. For me, I had to get to a point in my life where I kind of just quieted all sides. And I mean all sides, just people and talking. And just had to like reflect about what does it mean to be a human being? Mm-hmm. My own humanity, my own personal self-respect. Mm-hmm. Who is Brandon Wiley? What is Brandon Wiley? And so that question, what are you, as something that was negative, I flipped it. I reframed its meaning. And now it's more of an introspective, internal question that I ask for myself and that I ask other people. How do you identify or how do you feel with inside? Because once you are comfortable and you are confident with who you are inside, everybody else doesn't really matter. Their opinions don't matter. If you are proud to be what you are, own that.
That's right.
And that's how it always should be. And that's where I had to come to. And so that's what I always give the advice of others is you have to acknowledge who you are, of course, and what people see, because people see color. You know, people see color, that whole notion of, oh, I don't see color. Yes, you do.
Yes, you do.
It's very apparent. But what I'm saying is for the individual who might be struggling, you have to first just become comfortable with who you are and the person that was created.
That's right. That's right.
Just to clarify that, I mean, and that's touching for a person to have to wonder how to act instead of acting natural or whatever they are, and they're conscious of how they have to act. Let's touch on that, because I'm always fascinated in my journey with this community activism stuff of people talk to, when we have these community things between black and white dialogue, it's almost like someone's trying to discover whether I'm human or not. And they'll say, they'll pose this question, what do you all think? Or what do you all do? Or like, we're not human. And understand this, when I've done my research on this, and a lot of brothers, sisters, blacks, or whatever, get frustrated with me with this. There's no such thing as race. This is a new construction relatively to humankind. That's why scripture never mentions it. That's in Othello, when you go back to Shakespeare's time, he's not mentioned as quote unquote a black man. It's just a natural thing. We've been tricked into believing that this thing has always existed. There's never been a multinational place except for the United States when this happened. When you go and you really research Istanbul and you go to these places in Iraq and you go to these whatever, they've always, Rome, it wasn't monolithic at all. These people have always interacted and it wasn't determined by race. Race came after slavery or after Columbus, and then really when the United States started to form, or Jamestown or what have you, however you want to look at it, it comes there. And so now it's been weaponized. It's been used to say, well, if you're white, you got a little bit more, I guess, as Lyndon B. Johnson said, all I got to do is trick the white man into thinking he's a little bit better than the black man, and I got him. And it's been used and weaponized and politicized here to the point where it's damaging. And it's damaging that a child feels he has to act one way or another and ridiculed if he don't fit in this box. I just find that tragic. That's the word I would use, yeah. Tragic.
Profound, that comment, and absolutely on the mark. And how do we get, this is the work that you're doing, Brendan, I think, is helping people to see us, each of us, as human beings. Do you remember the Tree of Life shooting a couple of years ago in Squirrel Hill in Pittsburgh? In the aftermath at Anchi Hesed Temple here in town, they did a service, a memorial kind of service, a prayer service, and I was invited to be part of that. And what I shared there was a meme that I had seen, a photo that was being sent around on the internet, and the photo was of three little ones sitting in a sandbox, a black child, a white child, and a redhead child, and one boy, two girls. It was just a mix of the intention was, this is humanity. And the tagline on that meme was, my religion is love, and my race is human. And so profound, that stuck with me for all of these years now, so profound that that's what I try to emphasize in almost all my preaching these days. We do see color. I'm bald. People know that. They don't look past that. So who we are on the outside just isn't who we are. And trying to get people to see the beauty in others, to see the humanity in others. Man, it's hard, especially when you have political and religious leaders who are fomenting fear of the other in order to hold on to their particular place and status in the world. It's a tough problem, and the solution to that problem starts, I think, in small ways, doing the kind of work that Brandon's doing, the kind of work that you're doing, Mark. And slowly but surely, you know, a generation down the line, people develop new eyes to see.
Absolutely. And you know, I want to comment on that because it makes me think about a book that inspired me, or an individual that inspired me, was Malcolm X. And the reason, a lot of people don't know about the real true story of Malcolm X. You say Malcolm X and you automatically think, oh, he was anti-white, so the white man was evil. People forget about his pilgrimage to Mecca. And I remember reading that book. And if anybody ever gets the chance to read the autobiography of Malcolm X by Alex Haley, please do. So, one of my favorites. Mm-hmm. It's a phenomenal book. But the part that inspired me the most was his trip to Mecca, when he saw a unison of different individuals, yes, who looked different on the outside, but were all bound together by love and by respect, believing and worshiping the same. That was powerful for me. And before I started Opened Eyes, I read that book, and that was one of the books that inspired me. Was, you know, as an adult man, of course, he was at times, he was a little raw. You know, but the time was the time. Yeah. You know, everybody had to be a little raw, more so than ever. But for him to have that conversion of thought during that time, and in the heat of everything that was going on, it was beautiful. And it really inspired my work, you know, moving through to look at humanity in that way. While we respect what people's cultures are, because we have to, culture is beautiful. Yeah. What we look like on the outside is beautiful, but let's dig deeper on what's on that internal piece.
Yeah, that's one of the things that's so fascinating about your work, is because when you go into conversations like these, and having been in them myself and moderating a few myself, not as many as you at this point, you've become the resident expert in moderating these conversations in Erie, man. And I'm proud of the fact that so many people are calling you in to this. I genuinely believe for you it's a calling, which is why when you put it down, you had no choice but to pick it back up. You can always tell if it's something you're called to do. It's like, are you compelled beyond your own control? And if so, you're probably called to do it. But in any event, when you're doing this, how difficult is it to get people to open up? What patterns have you noticed started to emerge after you started doing these sessions? You know, quiet in the beginning, people come in with grandiose opinions, they change over time. What are some of the patterns that you've witnessed as people are tackling some of these tough conversations that you know they're just not accustomed to having?
Absolutely. Well, you know, by trade, I'm a licensed professional counselor, mental health counselor in the state of Pennsylvania. So, you know, part of my what's instinctual for me is to always analyze. I'm an analytical person. And so a lot of course, the skill set transfers over into the work I do with Opened Eyes, which I feel like it serves me very well. And part of that is part of our basis with our organization is mindfulness-based practice. You know, before I get into any type of diversity, equity, inclusion, I go through a mindfulness-based overview, a reflective properties, because I always say, before we get to the next, you have to look within first. Before you understand someone else, you always have to look at yourself and understand yourself first. And so we talk about that. And so when I come into these spaces, I'm very observing of nonverbals. You know, you see people with their arms crossed, like, oh, here we go again with another DE&I. What is this all going to be about? They're going to tell me how racist I am and xenophobic and sexist and all this stuff. And we come in with a whole different approach that blows them away. And I get it all the time. By the end of it, I always get some people that come up to me and say, this is not what I thought it was going to be. And that's what I want to hit on. That's the reaction that I wanted. I want you to think something different. And then I want to come in and I'm going to show you something else. I mean, that's always been my life has been centered around constant just obstacles. And I am a firm believer that I know what I bring to the table is effective. I know from my experiences, I can help. And I know that my product is effective, and it's going to help your organization. It's going to help your school district. It's going to help you as a person. I truly believe that. I put these practices into play in my own life. I don't do anything or say anything that I haven't practiced myself. And that's what I like to convey in those sessions. I'm not telling you anything that I haven't done. I'm not saying that I'm perfect. I expose some of my flaws and I give personal self-disclosure, and people appreciate that because it makes you a human being.
One of the biggest challenges I think that you face, we was talking before the show started, and you were saying you was in Texas. And one of my fears is that DEI, diversity, inclusion, and equity, or doesn't become equal opportunity. That sign that's in every business that I know of got some place in the staff lounge or something. We are an equal opportunity employer. We are what have you. And it's really like white noise, so to speak, pardon the pun, but it's just, it blended in. And it became a saying, but it wasn't a reality. And what I worry about, you have the sales of not just you, all diversity, inclusion, and equity, have the wind behind your back with George Floyd, but I feel with the rhetoric of DeSantis, with the rhetoric of Abbott, it's being pulled because they are saying, matter of fact, we're going to divest in that. And they're doubling down. They're pulling out all state resources. And I don't think the country understands, or people that's listening to the show understands what they're doing. Chuck said something very valuable. He said, they're attacking woke because it worked. They're attacking diversity and inclusion because it was effective. The law is already saying we're pulling back on affirmative action. The Supreme Court has already ruled elections have consequences, you people that sat out with the Hillary election. They're pulling back right now. So your job, I worry, like when you go into states like Texas, and as the new factories come into Texas, new factories are going in the South. That means transplants are coming in. And it's going to turn purple, whether they see it or not. It might be red now, but it's going to turn purple like Atlanta. Like Charlotte, those type of places, North Carolina, where you get the implants coming in and you're needed. And I worry with that pullback politically, how will you thrive in that environment in like a Texas or a Florida?
Absolutely. Well, no, that's a phenomenal question. And I've actually had multiple meetings with my team about this. Because I always said, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion. I said this 4 years ago. I said, it's the hot thing right now. It might not be the next thing next year. You know, what are we going to do to continuously try to push our message? And so sometimes you have to finagle. Sometimes you have to divert. The whole critical race theory thing, I don't, and this is just me personally, nothing that I do I consider critical race theory. I didn't even know what the hell it was about a year ago, to be honest with you. What I do, what we do, we named our own model. It's called Culturally Conscious Conversations, or C3. That is what we do, and that is rooted in mindfulness-based practice. That is rooted in healthy dialogue. It is rooted in understanding that diversity is a broad term. Obviously, we're going to talk about race, but it's much more than that. It's about the disability community. It's about diversity of thought. It's about organizational wellness. It's about workplace bias. And when you're talking to corporations, you say things like, if you're not being an inclusive practice or having inclusive practices in your workplace, your market shares may go down. You're going to lose money because and your competitor who is promoting inclusivity, they're going to have a 15% increase of revenue than you are. And that's going to hurt your dynamic, because the generational and cultural shifts, they can't stop that. Because the culture, this Gen Z generation is one of the most diverse generations of our time. And that's not going to stop. So the clientele is going to be diverse. You're going to need workers. They're going to be diverse. And their companies and their organizations are going to have to figure out what to do. And if they don't, they're going to fall behind. And these are the things that I try to convey to these organizations, that this is an important thing. If you provide this information, if you provide these workshops, if you provide an action plan to actually implement these policies and not just say it, not like the whole like the white noises you were talking about, equal opportunity employer. Like, what does that really mean? I've asked those questions before. Like, what are you doing to actually be an employer that, you know, thinks about inclusivity? And a lot of people don't even have that policy and procedure, or they have a policy from 1973. You know, they don't even revisit that diversity piece. And so it's a little bit difficult to for them to bring that to their attention. Is like, whoa, you're right. We have to get with the time. So my prediction is that those states who are a little bit, you know, rolling all these laws out and the affirmative action, at some point they're gonna need to get with the times. And I mean, that's just really what it comes down to. And surprisingly, when I was in Texas, I was speaking to the healthcare community there. They were all pretty on board with diversity related practices. You know, they were like, it's not that big of a deal for us. Like, we want to learn more about it. And I was speaking to over 200 medical professionals. They're for it. You know, it's not so much blackballed within the community there. So we still have an avenue. We have a window to really make an impact. But it is going to be tough, especially with these laws being rolled out.
He starts talking about Gen Z. You know, you think about, and Chuck, I know that we've got a show planned in the near future that touches on some LGBTQIA, transgender issues. This new generation is much less caught up in all of that as we are, right? And this new generation kind of looks at some of these things and they look at us and they say, "What? Why are you so hung up on that?" You know, and we try to give them our traditional rhetoric, whether it's rooted in the church or when, you know, Leave It to Beaver days and when things were, what's that got to do with me right now?
Right.
It's just a different take. Chuck, I know that when you talk to people, you know, this is, as you and I had this discussion the other day, you're looking at the reaction of this next generation on this very topic. What are you seeing?
Well, I think Brandon just hit it, that things are changing. It's one of the issues that we're going to deal with later along the way this fall in the program is climate change. And it's really interesting. I'm starting to see a lot of folks in the conservative branch of our political system who are writing conservative defenses of environmentalism because they're seeing that not only are we ruining the planet, and that's bad for most of us, but they're also seeing that there's an economic benefit to heading in this new direction, that solar power, wind power, sustainable energies are going to create more jobs long term and make us healthier and wealthier. And so they're trying to sell it from a different perspective. The guy who I'm going to have on this fall is an environmental lawyer who from Erie, who's been beating his head against the wall politically for years trying to get. He worked on the Kyoto Accords and a couple of other international accords that have to do with climate change. And he was so frustrated that nothing was really happening that he stepped away from that and started a business. And so they're now working with communities to bring in solar power grids and provide energy for local communities and for particular industries. And that's the direction that's making sense because money talks. Mm-hmm. And so when you can tell them, this is the way it's headed. And it's exactly why. And the depth or the vituperation of the response of people on the right now, the folks like Trump and DeSantis and Greg Abbott, and the reason that they're so pushing back so hard is they're afraid. That they know they're losing. And so I think this is the wounded animal coming out. You shine the light into the dark corner, and that wounded animal now has to do something. And that animal living in the dark corner. And this is what they're doing. It's the natural pushback to change. But if we can have more people like you guys who are doing your work, who are holding people's feet to the fire, and who are pushing the resilience that allows us to work through until we overcome the opposition, not by violence or any of that kind of thing, but we overcome them at the ballot box, and we overcome them economically. And we overcome them with attitudes that young people are bringing to the table. Absolutely. Now. So,
and you know, that's the thing too. I've been in so many spaces where, you know, our liberal brothers and sisters and our conservative brothers and sisters have been in, and we've all had healthy dialogue. It's very much possible. Absolutely. It's very much possible for all of us to come together. And I don't mean this just to be a kumbaya, sunshine and rainbows, because, you know, we all know life is life. But I really do think we can really truly have healthy dialogue. And that's really what I try to push at the end of the day. I don't subscribe, me personally, to one political side. My program is for everybody. My program is trying to reach everybody, whether you're liberal, whether you're conservative, whether you're Muslim, whether you're Christian, whatever. I want to be here to bring people together, because this is a collective idea that we all need to be a part of in order for us to advance to the next level, to build better communities, to build better just our whole country as a whole. Like, we all need to come together to do that. I'm trying to be inclusive, not exclusive. I mean, and that's really, I practice what I preach, and I truly believe in that inclusivity and what true inclusivity really means.
And if you talk to enough people, I think one of the things that you learn, I hope this is your experience, it's mine, and maybe it's because I'm a pastor and people respond in certain ways to pastors, but people are generally not going to dismiss you out of hand when you say, let's talk about this particular issue. Let's talk about whatever the issues are, guns. Let's talk about race. Let's talk about immigration. Let's talk about the environment. People, large percentages of people, are willing to think about these things and talk about these things and without anger and hatred developing. There's a small group that gets all of the press, mm-hmm. and gets all of the clicks, and those are the ones who, and they have undue influence, and so we need to speak out against them. It's one of the reasons that I call out my clergy brothers and sisters to speak about these issues, because we can't cede the floor or the microphone to them.
Absolutely.
I think it's easy to hijack the narrative when people do avoid these topics. It's one of the things I love about when people go after it.
For sure.
And actually take the time to engage, because when you don't, it can be demagogued. I looked at, you know, you mentioned Ron DeSantis in Florida, and even them trying to reframe a slavery. I heard a narrative that slavery was beneficial to blacks because it enabled them to learn some of the building trade skills and so on and so forth. And I thought, well, that's ironic, because you took those same building trade skills and you started protecting those jobs by forming unions who intentionally didn't want African Americans or black folks in those unions. And so you go from your theory that you just espoused to now in 2023, all of these job sites are looking for at least 10% minority participation, and most of them can't come up with it.
Absolutely.
Right? But it benefited us. And so it's so fascinating that you, when you watch people engage in this imprecisement, if you will, of laws and history and things along those lines. But it always goes back to, if you don't have the discussion, anybody can take the narrative, form it into whatever they want it to, shape it into whatever they want to see it become, and it becomes a semi-law. You know, almost what we talked about in the Bible. not necessarily this per se, but, you know, I heard somebody say on the show before, they were talking about State of the Black Community. Farrakhan was on the show, Louis Farrakhan, if you aren't familiar and you're listening. And somebody made a very spirited point that the Apostle Paul made in the Bible. Farrakhan said very quietly, did Jesus say it? Meaning Paul had his opinions, yeah. Right? When Paul said, I'd rather you be single, that's not law, that was Paul's opinion, right? But some people will take that and build doctrine around yeah. it, you know, especially if they're in an audience that isn't inspecting that book for themselves. And that's what it is when it comes to these type topics. If you aren't digging into the history of the evolution of, you talk about race as a social construct, Mark, and I know that when Lynn Johnson is on the show, that's the favorite angle he attacks this thing from. It's important to have historical perspective on the topic.
Understand this, those that came up with some of these phrases. Let's take the word Caucasian. I challenge you to go back and look at who he included in that word. It wasn't the Italians. It wasn't the Irish. So when we say what is white today, like we debate whether Cleopatra was all these things, what was Jesus, all these things, it didn't matter then. And really, if you talk to some of these quote unquote new Americans today, the Nigerian don't see himself as black. He sees himself as a Nigerian. And then yet when we say these things, like in the United States, they'll say, well, black people don't do well on tests. Nigerians and West Indies sure do. So what are they? So it has to be some other dynamic that's affecting us here. And that's what I'm saying. I'm not saying that I don't have a plight or a journey to take or a different experience because I'm an African-American, because I do. Mm-hmm. James Baldwin says it all the time. He puts it together way better than I could ever do it. I'm just telling you that we're operating under a false narrative. And once you empower yourself with understanding what truths are, understanding that we need a little bit more than dialogue. We're going to have to deal with gerrymandering. We're going to have to deal with voting. If young people, you want something, you're going to have to vote. You don't vote. That's just the truth. You don't vote. So therefore, we cater to these old Mitch McConnell type people, and they cater to them, and they elect people. And these people have the power to affect our realities by their rulings, by their policies. So you have to understand, we have to play all these games. We have to play the health game, the education game, all of them, and be a part of it. Feel like it's yours, because it is. Mm-hmm. So that's what I would like to see coming down the pike. And I would hope that this right here, these type of conversations that we have in today on this show will spread some seeds out, and hopefully it inspires some people to do some things.
And with all that being said, you have now learned why we are so happy that Open Eyes has grown from what we saw in 2015 in that early interview to what it is today, because it is sorely needed in society, and the need will continually grow as America continues to diversify, and all the numbers show that the browning of America continues from so many different shades of brown, black, and other. And you can also understand why we're injecting these voices, Chuck Camerota and Mark Blunt, into the show on a regular basis, because they bring something of value to Next. And so in this 2.0 iteration, we will have fun with these multi-takes and bring different people in. We'll be on location. You'll hear us at coffee shops. You'll hear us at bars. Mark and I did an interview with Mishka Vodka, and you'll hear that. And we're at one of the local taverns.
Did they invite you to the vodka thing, Brandon?
I didn't get, no.
I didn't get invited. I was invited.
And we drank all the vodka. Yes, that was real vodka served at that interview. You will hear us all over the place. Listen, this has been fun. We're looking forward to you tapping into this new iteration, Next 2.0. Thank you guys so much for coming on the show. Thank you for giving us informed takes. Brandon, thank you for just doing the work that you're doing.
Appreciate
it. And gracing our microphones with your words of wisdom on this particular topic. I'm Marcus Atkinson for Next 2.0. We will see you next time, and not next month, but actually next week this time, so that we can continually talk about the issues of the day and what's next for not just our city, but for our state and our country, and dare I say, your world. We'll talk to you next time.